Yesterday, a federal judge ordered a mental evaluation for Jared Loughner to determine whether the suspect in the shootings in Tucson is competent to stand trial. U.S. District Judge Larry Burns ordered Loughner to a Federal Bureau of Prisons facility in Springfield, Missouri. Loughner's defense attorneys argued that an independent expert, not a government-appointed evaluator, should conduct the exam and that moving Loughner out of Tucson for the assessment could harm him. Mental competency evaluations are common features on TV police procedurals like Law and Order, but what exactly are they? How are they conducted? What role do they play in the criminal justice system? If you're a mental health professional, does the mental evaluation system work? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And joining us now is Dr. Eileen Ryan, an associate professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia, medical director of their Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. She's on the phone from her office in Charlottesville, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hello.
And I guess the first thing we should establish is what this examination it is not. It is not to determine whether the person in question was sane at the time of the alleged crime.
That's correct. That's a completely different type of forensic evaluation.
So what are they doing here?
Well, the requirement that a defendant be competent to stand trial dates back to 17th century, and it's rooted in English common law. And in American courts, competency really has its roots in the concept of fairness. So we really want to see if the defendant has the capacity to get a fair trial. And what the competency to stand trial standard is, that's been actually set by the Supreme Court. They held that competence to stand trial is really fundamental to our system of justice. And the way that they defined competency to stand trial is whether the defendant, whether the accused, has sufficient present ability to consult with his or her lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding, and whether he or she has a rational as well as a factual understanding of the proceedings against him or her.
Could you summarize that by saying participate in their own defense?
Need to be able to understand what's going on, what they're charged with, what the potential penalties are, and they need to be able, yes, to assist their lawyer in their own defense.
And what happens if they are judged not competent to stand trial?
Well, that's a determination that's made by the court. A psychiatrist or a psychologist performing that evaluation is basically opining as to whether that person has the capacity, the capacities necessary for competence. If the judge rules that they're not competent to stand trial, then the question would be, can they be restored to competency? And in the case of severe mental illness, typically that restoration to competence would involve treatment of the psychiatric disorder,
and that
typically with medications.
And that could take years.
It potentially could, but it often takes less than that.
And you say medication. Could a prisoner be forced to take medication against his or her will?
Well, there have been cases in which that has come up. And yes, in terms of serving the purpose of justice and bringing someone to trial, yes, someone can be forced to take medication against their will. That's typically after an extremely long process in which the defense attorneys are, bringing motions to the court regarding that issue.
Okay. And there is then the question of location. Why would the judge order Jared Loughner removed to a facility all the way from Tucson to Springfield, Missouri?
Well, there can be many reasons. I'm not sure what they would be in this particular case. It really would depend on the defendant, him or herself, what the case is about, what the ideas are on the part of the defense attorney and the prosecutor. There's nothing inherent in a competency to stand trial evaluation itself that demands that it be one place or the other, but everyone, the court, the defense, and the prosecution you know, really has an interest in an investment in a very thorough examination. And a thorough examination, you know, needs to be performed under the conditions that are really the most likely to produce valid and reliable results. So sometimes in an inpatient facility, you can do a more thorough evaluation.
Okay, so that might explain. But why might the prosecution be interested in saying there should be a Bureau of Prisons facility in Springfield, Missouri, halfway across the country, and the defense say, wait a minute, we would prefer an independent expert right here in Tucson?
Well, I don't know why in this particular case. You know, typically attorneys have their reasons for wanting particular evaluations done by certain people in certain places. One thing may be that there may be the perception that a certain type of evaluation may be done by, for example, psychiatrists or psychologists employed by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so, given the fact that we have an adversarial system, there may be a desire to, you know, obtain an expert that, for example, the defense may know does a very thorough evaluation versus an expert that the defense does not know. Same thing can be true of the prosecutor.
Sure. Everybody prefers their own, I guess.
Right.
And in such an evaluation, obviously everyone is different, but typically what kinds of questions are asked?
Well, you're really doing a thorough evaluation that is looking at, first of all, a forensic evaluation is different from a clinical evaluation in that there isn't confidentiality, and so the defendant needs to know that. There isn't a doctor-patient relationship. You're looking at relevant background information, and you're looking at information and presenting that information in a way that would be relevant to competency. So you don't want information, for example, in a report that is going to in any way bear on the alleged offense. So you're looking at family history, personal history, educational history, particularly if one of the areas that's being looked at in the competency evaluation is some sort of cognitive deficit, for example, mental retardation. You're looking at relationship history, medical history can be very important, drug and alcohol history, and then, of course, psychiatric history.
Mm-hmm.
You're also doing any relevant evaluations, examinations that need to be done, including psychological testing, if that is indicated. If there isn't an indication for specific psychological tests, there's no reason to do them. A mental status examination, which is really kind of the psychiatric equivalent of a physical examination, in which you're examining the defendant's thought processes, thought content, trying to understand if there is evidence of a severe mental illness, for example, psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're asking questions that are specific to that competency standard that I mentioned before. You know, you want to ask questions that would get to whether the defendant understands and appreciates the charges, whether they understand the trial process, whether they've got the capacity to work with their attorneys around preparing a defense.
Mm-hmm.
For example, someone who is psychotic and paranoid may feel like his or her defense attorney is in some sort of a conspiracy with the judge and with the prosecution. That would obviously impair the person's ability to work with their attorney. So you're looking at those kinds of questions.
Well, let's get a caller in on the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Eileen Ryan about the competency, the mental competency exam process. And we'll start with Nicholas. Nicholas with us from Sacramento.
Yeah, how you doing today, Neil?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, my question actually is that your guest has made a comment that if a person is, you know, is found that at the time maybe they're not completely mentally sound, that they can be sometimes induced to take medication and as a result bring somewhat be brought back to competency. But how does that actually hold up as far as when the crime was committed, they obviously weren't of sound mind, so to reinduce some kind of a state of consciousness, I don't understand. I guess I'm having a problem with if they weren't competent at the time, but yet if drugs are going to make them aware of the situation, does that really change their mental state at the time of the crime?
Well, that's a great question, and it doesn't, because those are two different evaluations. The competency to stand trial is very much a here and now assessment. So really, someone needs to be competent to stand trial in order to go forward. So in order for someone to, for example, to progress to the point where they are asserting an insanity defense, for example, which is mental state at the time of the alleged offense, they need to be competent in order to present that that defense. So you can be competent to stand trial, and you can be competent to stand trial without medications, without you can have a competency to stand trial evaluation and be found by the judge competent to stand trial without ever being forced to take any medications, but still assert an insanity defense, because that would really be pertaining to the way you were at the time that the alleged crime was committed.
Nicholas, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about the mental competency examination. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go next to this is Glenn. Glenn with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, I had 2 points. First was regarding juveniles. We get into some sticky issues with this, where a juvenile is at risk of punishment as an adult, but of course they don't get any of the rights and responsibilities of an adult. And if they're found innocent, they go back to being children again. Is there any kind of evaluation to determine that a person who's 16 is actually of the sound mind of an adult when they committed a crime, or is it just at the whim of the prosecutor? And I had a second point.
And obviously this does not apply to Jared Loughner, who was 23. But anyway, go ahead, Eileen Ryan.
Well, that's a very complicated issue, and it really it sort of varies from state to state. In most states, juveniles, depending on their age and the legislation in various states, can be tried as adults. Some states, that's 16. Some states, it's 14. And if you are tried as an adult, then you are able to have the same possible defenses.
But that determination of being tried as an adult, that's a determination by the prosecutor, not by any examination by anybody.
Well, whether or not one is tried as an adult, whether one is bound over to adult court, that's a determination that can be made by, depending on the state again, it can be made by legislature. I mean, there are certain states in which for certain crimes, such as murder, the prosecutor doesn't make that decision. You're automatically tried as an adult if you're a certain age. Now, when that happens, and in states, regardless of whether you're tried as an adult or whether you remain in juvenile court, you can obtain a competency to stand trial evaluation. Right. So there's competency to stand trial evaluations that are done on juveniles who are staying in the juvenile system, and then there are competency to stand trial evaluations of juveniles in the adult system. So regardless of where you are, you have to be competent to stand trial to proceed.
Now let's go next to Tim, and Tim's with us from Hyde Park in Utah.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
My brother was recently convicted of the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart, and he was repeatedly found incompetent to stand trial in the state court and spent a lot of time in the hospital because of a delusional psychosis. Well, finally, the federal court, when they charged him on that, they hired a guy named Wellner from out of New York, paid him $500,000, and he finally declared my brother competent to stand trial, But my brother was not willing to actually talk to most of these people. So they did the competency off of statements of family members, statements of, you know, the you know, young woman who was kidnapped and so forth. And finally, that's the way they kidnapped him. I mean, they finally convicted him based on that. But
I don't mean to cut you off, but we're running out of time, and I wanted to give Eileen Ryan a chance to respond. And she may not be familiar with this particular case, but that procedure in general.
Yeah, we kept...
Let's let Dr. Ryan...
Well, you know, again, these are very much individualized cases, and competency really is contextual. In one of the things that's very important is that it's got to be the evaluator is looking at many things. Again, I'm not commenting on that particular case or the case of this man's brother, but one of the things that all forensic evaluators are assessing is whether someone is incapable of working with his or her attendee.
But if the person refuses to cooperate with the examiner, then you could go to other sources.
Unwillingness versus incapacity.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, I'm sorry we ran out of time. This is an interesting question. Tim joined us on the line from Hyde Park in Utah. And Dr. Ryan, thank you very much for your time today.
Sure.
Dr. Eileen Ryan, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia, with us on the line from her office in Charlottesville. Tomorrow, legendary comedian Carol Burnett joins us to take your calls. Be there for that. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.